until at the gala when the awards were being doled out, one of the organizers pulled me aside and he's like, have you figured it out yet? Like, no, figured what out? And, brewery of the year, do you have a speech ready? I'm like, do I have a what? He's like, oh, well, we're going to announce it in like 20 minutes. So like, you better start working on your speech.
So the beers that you won for, were they mostly like traditional styles? What's the secret to crafting something beautifully that a lot of people know what it tastes like and what it should taste like?
I mean, the thing with those beers is it kind of isn't a secret. Like, a handful of those styles have been around for well over a century, some of them longer than that. And they're recipes of the big breweries that have like that are famous for producing those styles are readily available on the internet. And it's more just kind of technique and process and, you know, sourcing the ingredients from the places where, you know, like the beer is from. Like our Irish Red and our Irish Stout both won medals in this recent one, and we bring in malt from the British Isles, we bring in hops from the British Isles, right? And we adjust our water profile to be more or less like, I use cork water, I don't use Dublin water. Cork, for those of you who aren't sure, Cork is a county in Ireland, as well as a city in Ireland. I don't put actual corks in the water. It is just like taking the time, doing the research, getting the fine details right, and going through enough of the research where, you know, I didn't just copy and paste a recipe for any of these beers. It was just going through the research and finding the respected brewers who had like put literature on the internet and kind of synthesizing my own take on everything that's already out there. As far as like, you know, we're kind of known in the industry as, or like in our little corner of the industry as kind of like beer lunatics, and like we're doing, you know, weird stuff, and you know, my philosophy with that has always been, well, learn how to do the base beer properly first, and then, you know, once you've got the base beer that tasting a certain way and you're happy with it, what else works on top of or in conjunction with the flavors of that base beer? And so even our wildest stuff has a good foundation underneath it. And that's the stuff that we advertise a little bit more and we bring to beer festivals and stuff. Like, that reputation is well earned. Like, we try and be a bit weird about things. But I am pretty happy that 5 of the 6 medals were for traditional styles, because it kind of showcases the other side of our brewery, which is when we want to take a run at something that's very well established, we look at the style guidelines. We taste the beers from the breweries that made those styles famous, and we, you know, we let that inform how the beer is going to go here moving forward.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
And I don't know if we'll have time. We might do a little report a little later on about how Nanaimo has already lost the world record for the world's largest Nanaimo bar. They only won it 2 months ago.
Is this something they created, the very concept of what a Nanaimo bar is, which is a bunch of butter and a slab of chocolate, it seems to me.
Sounds good to me.
But that's what it is. It's butter and chocolate. I mean, that's what it is.
That's a lot of sweet baking, though.
A bit of
flour, a lot of butter, some sugar.
It's sort of like the Vancouver special. Not anything. No part of the world has decided to do this monstrosity of a concept, except here in British
you
Columbia.
You are the curmudgeon today, aren't you?
Well, I mean, it's just butter and a slab of chocolate.
Yeah, but the whole thing about baking is you take the ingredients and do some magic and turn it into something amazing. Have you ever looked at how they make flaky pastries?
I've got type 2, which is at a low level, so I'm not supposed to have beer. Supposed to have Nanaimo bars.
Oh, that, I see.
Yeah, a little
bit. It's bitterness that's coming out.
Well, no, I mean, I also thought it was kind of a strange concept. I have it at a low level. I take Tabs. I'm doing okay, but you're doing things that I can't partake in, Magnus, okay?
All right. Well, we may try and squeeze that in later. So as I mentioned earlier, I was doing some traveling, and of course by airplane, and of course you check in and out of things a million times when you're flying, coming and going, and you know, before you even get to the airport, then at the airport, then through security, then when you get to the boarding gate and you get check again, and on the you know and. This, of course, is normal, and ever since 9/11, you know, they've jumped up security quite a bit. Used to be that they didn't really, as long as you had your ticket and your boarding pass, they were going to let you on the airplane, which allowed people to resell air tickets if they couldn't use them, and then, of course, that went away. I did notice that when I was in Norway, I did a bunch of a couple internal flights, and they didn't really bother to check our ID when we got on the plane there. They just, you scan the QR code in your boarding pass to be admitted onto the plane, and away you go. But one thing that happened on our final flight, we were flying from a transit airport in the United States at Newark, New Jersey, to come back to fly back to Vancouver. And they announced that they were going to be doing a special procedure, testing out facial recognition as you boarded the plane. Because typically what you do is you got your boarding pass and you have your ID. And nowadays, you know, they used to actually look at your boarding pass and mark you off on the computer. Nowadays, you scan the QR code and it does that automatically for you. On this one, we are specifically instructed not to scan our boarding pass or our passports as we came up. We just came up, stood on two footprints on the floor, and they took our picture and then used facial recognition to recognize us. And when the light went green, the gate went open and you got on the airplane.
Okay.
Which I see you're not impressed. And my point my point isn't about the technology, because we know facial recognition is something, you know, I mean, for many people, their phones will do that to unlock it. But, you know, the creep of these technologies.
I've still got a landline. Last of the landliners.
Because you can imagine that, you know, this is one thing they're doing. They will probably have all the security cameras around the airport set up to do facial recognition and watch you, track you as you move around the airport. And then who, you know, and I think probably you can justify all that in the context of an airport.
But when it comes to Walmart, we're in trouble.
Or just walking around on the street.
Yeah.
I know in the UK they have a lot of video camera surveillance on public spaces. You know, and if they, you know, if they were to employ, and I don't think they do that now, but if they were to employ, you know, facial recognition in that situation, you know, tracking people as they just move around. Nowadays with license plate scanning cameras, you know, when a parking authority, whether it's here on the campus or anywhere, they don't go around anymore and read your license plate to see if you have paid your parking ticket. Typically, when you buy a parking ticket, you put in your license plate for the and the time. Now they just drive around with a camera equipped car, and they automatically read the license plates and then compares it to their database to know whether your ticket is still valid, and then they can give you a ticket just like that. But that same technology can be used on public streets to monitor cars moving around. And there are certain privacy implications about being able to track everywhere you go. Everywhere you go in your car, you can be tracked. Everywhere you walk around, you can be tracked through facial recognition. It's a bit, it's a little creepy, don't you think?
Well, in George Orwell's 1984, in the book first published in 1949, and the what I call the 1956, 1984, the British film, they had television not as Texaco Star Theater, was Melton Burrow, but it was that the TV watched you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're 41 years late, but it's kind of happened, because I saw something on YouTube, because they always got those postings you didn't ask for, you know, over on the side. Yeah. One was about a TV set, like just like TV set, I got a big one, that is watching you when they're not, we're not telling you. So I mean, so it's 41 years late, but it's happened.
Yeah, do you, eye tracking to see if you're watching the ads and weird stuff like that. I read somewhere that they there's one that would, if you got up and left the room to like, oh, it's ads, I'm going to go to the kitchen and get something.
A TV set.
Yeah, yeah. It would pause the timer on how long the ads were supposed to run. I think they got some backlash and maybe stopped that because that just seems really creepy. But, you know, most TVs these days, you have to, they're smart TVs, right? So they come up with some, you know, media players and things like that so you can, you know, access your streaming services and stuff like that. And that's built into the, and one of the things they do, I think this is pretty well known, is that then they sell, they track, you can't use the TV without it being plugged into the internet, even if you just want to run something for
I have no internet.
I know, but I mean,
and I got a TV.
Well, you're lucky then, because they track and record everything you're doing with your television and share that data with advertisers and stuff.
I have an 8-year-old TV set that's huge. I mean, by when I was a child, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's no status symbol now because the status symbol of a mini TV you're looking at on the bus. But I don't have cable. I have a sort of what used to be called rabbit ears, but it's flat.
Yep.
And so I don't think it's tracking me somehow.
Yep. Okay, we better get on with our next story. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time here. This is a reprise edition of Gardening with Embark from last month. All right, welcome to Gardening with Embark. Joining me here in the studio is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and our resident gardening expert.
Hi, good morning.
So, good morning. So we've spent the last couple of weeks, we're sort of in the middle, getting to the middle of the season, and we already have, you know, some of the crops we put in the ground coming up.
Correct. Yeah,
and we're harvesting them, and we're also have some other plants that are sort of coming up that we'll be producing later in the summer that we need to think about. So we're busy with everything that's going on.
Yes, but, as you mentioned, the garden is very busy at the moment with lots of crops, garden beds full of vegetables. Harvesting, maintaining, watering.
But even with all that going on, we still need to be thinking ahead. We can't get caught up in the moment.
Correct. So here at Embark, we encourage to all our gardeners to garden year-round. So just don't focus on the spring and summer, but let's go over the winter too. So at the moment, it's just the right time to start thinking what I would like to grow in the fall. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned, we are just so busy harvesting time, pinching, keeping the garden wet, watered and weeded and mulched and all that. But let's stop a little while and think why I would like to grow over the fall. So at the moment, we have a good weather. So the soil is warm, lots of long days. Mm-hmm. So it's the time to select a section in the garden that is not full sun, but is in the shade or half shade. And that will be where we start our nursery. And particularly if we would like to have Brussels sprouts for Christmas, for winter break, now is the time to start our nursery where we come and start all Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccoli, overwintering cabbage, and as well the Walla Walla onions if we want to start from seeds. So this is the right time to start because the Walla Walla onions is a very nice vegetable that overwinters very nice. So we can keep it growing over the winter. So now, but they are very slow. They are very slow seeds. So we need to start right in these 2 weeks that we have. Yeah. So we can have a nice little seedlings by September to transplant when we harvest all our summer crops.
Excellent. So you mentioned about the plot should be sort of part sun, part shade. Why is that important?
Because it's important. Because we don't want to having to water constantly, so we want that the seedlings don't get too much sun when they are so young. Mm-hmm. So we just want them to get this good weather, but not to overexposed to the sun. That as well, because when nurseries already need to be frequently watered. But if we put in the direct sun, we will almost watering every day. So we don't want to do that. Yeah. So keep the soil moist, but in a nice shady area. Or at the moment even it's good because at the moment as well we have to identify which area for our garden site has this kind of environment.
Right.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. So here, for instance, in the learning garden, we have a garden bed underneath a tree. Mm-hmm. So this is our preferred area. So the sunlight just filters to the leaves or the tree and reach to the garden bed. And that garden bed is always moist. We don't have to worry about that. Oh, I forgot to water. And when we realize, our plants are all suffering in stress. Yeah. So it's nice, keeps the soil moist, not much light. But again, it's nice and warm and the plants are just happy.
So it sounds like, we're sort of going back to planting gardens, because often, people are focusing on things like tomatoes, which want lots and lots and lots of sun. But when you're planting your garden, putting your boxes out, it might be a good idea to sort of have some. Maybe you got one over in a different part of your garden or area that is like this with some shade.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So in our garden here, we have some boxes that are directly full sun. So every day get the sun, and the others are underneath trees, so they are in the shade. So those are our favorite boxes to start a nursery.
Right. So with these fall and winter plants, are we mainly starting from seeds here?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So we start from seeds, Walla Walla onions, the Brussels sprouts. We can have cabbages, over winter cabbages, broccoli, sprouting broccolinis. They are the main crops that we like for the fall. Now, we should remember that the vegetables that do very well in the fall are the same vegetables that do very well in the spring. Mm-hmm. However, when we start in the spring, the temperature goes from cold to hot.
Yeah, right.
On fall, it's the opposite. It goes from hot to cold, but the same type of vegetables. So if the vegetables can stand cold weather, they will stand the cold weather at the end of the season or the fall. So peas very much starting in September. So by October, they are just in the right weather that they like it. But starting right now is for all those vegetables that take at least 8 weeks to germinate and turn into a nice seedling.
So that's quite a long time, 8 weeks. So we're gonna be putting things in the ground now.
Yes.
And tending that ground with regular watering and stuff. It's going to be a little while before we start seeing shoots coming up.
Yes. So at the moment, we will put the seeds and they germinate in 1 week. They should be up.
Okay.
And then we have to take care because at the moment, that there is slugs around, which love seedlings.
Yeah.
We have aphids around that as well like seedlings. So we have to take care of those little seedlings. And I overseed. So just counting that some of them are going to be eaten by these slugs.
Right. So are you out there every day looking for issues? Or how attentive do we need to be to these shoots?
Well, every time that we water the garden, we get in contact with our plants. I advise to do hand watering. So water with a watering wand and you go and at the time, touch new plants. If you are watering the soil, you will be removing, keeping your leaves around, collecting the plant, hiking the plant while you water around the soil. Okay. So that's the way that we get in contact with the plants and we can see, there is aphids, there are ants and why there are so many ants. And it's beautiful to see when there is a ladybug around.
Mm-hmm.
And slugs, usually they show up around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you gardening has troubles with the slugs, just show around 5 o'clock, and then you will find them just coming out from their hiding, ready to start munching on the vegetables. There is two options. You pick them and dispose them in the composter or somewhere else, or you just find a way to get rid of the slugs. With aphids, very much I look for ants. Mm-hmm. When ants go up and down a plant, means that there are aphids, and I just follow the ants and they direct me where the aphids are. At the moment, we have two types that have shown. We have the black ones, black aphids, and the green aphids. They are the two ones I have seen in our gardens. And I keep the I keep an eye on the population. So if there is one plant that is sick, that's all right. And the nearby plants are all okay. They are not affected, so that's okay. And if it's a small population, I still use my hands to squish the aphids into the underneath the leaves. Just squish. I avoid to doing a jet spraying on the leaves. The leaves get damaged. And right. So I avoid that because the leaves are the food factory of a plant. They yeah. Through photosynthesis, they create sugars. So why to damage that? So I just prefer to squish them, yeah. So aphids, and yeah, if they're ladybugs, awesome. Now at the moment, ladybugs are laying eggs.
Yeah,
which they turn into a small caterpillar, they will say, and that caterpillar will turn into another insect, look like a little crocodile, and then we turn into a ladybug. So we have to be very careful that we don't destroy the middle stage of the ladybug from egg mm-hmm. to adult. So we have to be very careful that yeah. not by accident we just say, oh, this is an insect. I'm
going to
squish it.
All right, we're gonna cut it short there for this episode of Gardening with Embark. New episodes will return next week on this very program, and you can also find them online on our CJSF SoundCloud page. Search for us on SoundCloud for CJSF FM. You will find our account with lots of our stories there, and the regular weekly episodes of Gardening with Embark. And we also share them typically on our social media channels, so you can look for them there as well. If you want to give us feedback or talk about anything you hear on CJSF, you can give us a call at or send a text. Either one works. 778-782-2573. That's the studio telephone right here in the studio with us. As I say, you can call, but it might be better to send us a text. Give us your thoughts on what you hear, or if you got questions or want information about something you hear, you can do that for any show. 778-782-2573. Call or text us anytime with your feedback. Peter, we're going to carry on our conversation about international.
More than 3 weeks ago, on Thursday, we recorded 3 50-minute segments.
Yeah. Which ran during the weeks we were away.
And it was Adam Tendowski and Stephen Fan did most of the talking, as you remember.
Yeah.
And the last week, we broadcast last 15 minutes. Now, it sort of, the last one, which I heard, I do hear our show, I was making the point, why was South Africa, once apartheid ended, why did it have to pay off its debt? And Stephen Fan, it sort of gave me a bit of an argument, like, oh, they're the big banks that gave them the debt, it was too big to fail or something mm-hmm. like that. I like to just come back. Stephen Fan's not here. Maybe he'll be here next week. Now, what happened? Here's when Nelson Mandela walked out of prison, rich countries and banks handed him and the people of our of South Africa a bill of 28 billion pounds, which we kind of figured is a bit more than American dollars. But that was the debt mm-hmm. that was handed to them. Now then, this is, this is South African National Debt, Wikipedia. As of 2021-2022, total South African government debt was $130 billion. Now, I perhaps see maybe Stephen Fan would say, well, they got debt from other things. And what they say here, by 2009, South Africa's debt to GNP ratio dropped to 28% from 34% in 2006. South Africa's debt grew from between 2008 and 2012 as the country prepared for the 2010 FIFA World Cup and ran a counter-cycle fiscal policy response to the 2008 financial crisis and the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic. So it could be said that now they now have a debt from other things. However, I think they weren't given a good foothold to begin with, and that got them in the debt spiral. Perhaps not the whole thing. And here in 1977, IMF lent more to South Africa, which was apartheid regime, mm-hmm. than all other African countries combined. And in 1986, still apartheid regime, the World Bank hid a loan for a water project, which wound up not being that successful, actually. And also here, in 1985, the apartheid regime ran out of credit, but Swiss national banks gave them a two-year extension. I mean, there was just constant collaboration with the global banking elites, kind of, as I see it, backing up an apartheid regime. And here is something here from the internet, not Wikipedia, something else. Odious debt, also known as illegitimate debt, is a legal doctrine stating that debts incurred by a despot region against the interest of the people should not be responsible, be the responsibility of a successful of a successor government. Essentially, it argues that such debts are the personal debts of the regime that incurred them, not the debts of the state or its people. Well, this is a legal term, and it has never been applied to South Africa.
I don't know if it's been applied to many countries, though. I think the general tendency is to have the debt transfer stay with the country and not the regime. I'm not sure if there's that. I kind of wish Stephen was here because he probably has more up-to-date information. I think we should revisit that question next week, though.
Yeah. No, I'm just... but as I say, the international banking community, including mm-hmm. the World Bank, the IMF, and actually the World Bank, the IMF, are part of the United Nations system.
Yeah,
I mean, I've been over the years. They said it's not part of the United Nations; it was part of the system, so it has UN backing. Yeah. And so their behavior with the apartheid regime is it's totally unacceptable, so a lot of people, some people say, well, South Africa now has a bad regime. Some people even say it was better under apartheid, whatever. I mean, maybe aspects of it were. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying what some people said. I wouldn't buy that. But the point is that I think it was they were given in odorous debt or whatever the term was. Anyway, so, and I – well, maybe Stephen Fan can sort of be – I don't quite know where he's coming from, mm-hmm. really, because I just think it was not right what happened. And so Adam's the same way. Mm-hmm. Adam seems to think I'm not quite right in my opinions on this.
All right. Well, thanks for that perspective, Peter. We'll maybe continue this conversation next week, see if perhaps Stephen will be here as well. Thank you for listening to any last words.
Oh, it's okay. Here's one for what's Danny. The bus rates went up, and you're talking about some beer thing. I don't know. I got to be totally against that. I don't know. Sorry.
I can see Danny sitting in the
next Danny.
Over.
I have to pay more for my single.
Is that the issue
pass.
You're really outraged about?
Well, I'm just this beer stuff I'm not so happy about.
All right. Just a quick forecast before we finish up the program. Democracy Now! Is coming up in about 35 seconds. Looks like a really nice week here in Vancouver. Sunny throughout the entire week, peaking at around 24, 25 in midweek before cooling off again with a bit of cloud on next weekend. But overall, a pretty nice weekend. Pretty nice week, and you can count on that sun. It says the humidex level will be up to 25, which I didn't quite know what it meant, but apparently 20 to 29 is good. 30 to 39 is getting uncomfortable. Above 40 is messy. So altogether, a nice, moderate, sunny week that probably is going to be comfortable. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!